Good morning and welcome to another International Connection. Today is part two of a three-part interview I conducted with Claudia Mullen, a survivor of U.S. government mind control at Tulane University in New Orleans. Claudia introduced testimony of mind control experimentation to the Presidential Committee on Human Radiation Experiments in 1995. This interview is part of an eight-month series on mind control we're doing on the International Connection, which runs until October of this year. And now, Claudia Mullen.
I described the inside of places that supposedly I'd never been to, and yet I could describe the inside, what room I'd gone to, what it looked like, things like that. That's how it was verified.
And did you or other people actually go to revisit any of these places you were describing? And
I went to a few with my therapist. I would never recommend going back to any place where abuse happened by yourself, because you immediately go into a flashback when you go back to some place. We went to some places around New Orleans that I had been to. One was a camp, an arsenal, that's now a police training facility, and they allowed us to go in and look around. And it was called Nichols, Camp Nichols, and it's in New Orleans. And Dr. Green, L. Wilson Green, used to stay there when he was in New Orleans. I found out later that it was sort of a place where military people could stay when they came to New Orleans, and it also doubled as an arsenal. And we went there. I went to back to Tulane, which was pretty scary because that's where a lot of the stuff happened. And I kept, I showed her the room. I said, it's room 302, third floor of Tulane. And I described what the hall would look like, what was on the wall. And sure enough, a lot of it was the same. Of course, there were empty rooms. They weren't being used, but it was exactly the way I described it. And then some of the people that verified the information actually went to different places. And the only place they couldn't get into was Edgewood Arsenal. In Fort Detrick, Maryland.
And you remember being experimented on within Edgewood Arsenal?
Yeah, I had been there, and I could describe the place, but very few people have been inside of it. It did turn out that one of the people that was verifying the information that I sent they would interview different people, and a couple of times I interviewed people that I actually remember from my childhood that remembered me, only they remembered me as Crystal Stone, which was my name back then. That's what they called me in the experiments, Crystal Stone. And this man interviewed several people, and one had actually been inside Edgewood and remembered a portrait of Dr. Green that was on the wall. And she said the description that I gave of him was exactly like the picture, that he looked just like the picture. And then he interviewed another man, a doctor, that had come to see me at Tulane, but had walked out and refused to take part in the experiment because they were using electric shock on me. And I was about 13 at the time. And he was furious. He said, nobody told me that you were using children. And he refused to participate. And when he was interviewed by this man, the doctor remembered, I remember a little blonde-haired girl, skinny blonde-haired girl named Crystal. And so that was sort of verification. But he's asked not to be named.
Okay. Just to reiterate, when you first approached the police about the rape that happened, what did you start remembering at that point before you got in contact with Valerie Wolf?
Actually, as far as any of this stuff, I didn't remember anything. I was mainly having nightmares about the rape. I did try to contact some people from my childhood that I thought had been, you know, one was a family friend, a doctor who I thought had been a family friend, who had been someone I had always gone to when I had a problem, and it turns out he was my monitor or controller. He was the one who was supposed to keep track of me my whole life and make sure that my memories didn't start coming back, and when they did, he would take me back to Tulane. And but I remembered him as a good person, you know, like an uncle. And then I did call Dr. Robert Heath, because I remembered him from my childhood as a doctor I'd gone to see. And I remembered him as being a kindly old man that, you know, had always treated me nice. And I didn't even remember what kind of doctor he was. I just knew the name, and I looked it up in the phone book, and I called him, and he said I needed to come in. And he remembered me, you know. But actually, after the rape, it wasn't until I was in the hospital about 3 months later that I started having flashbacks of other people hurting me, other men. Not the rapist, but, you know, other people.
Right.
And everybody, my doctor and the nurses, everybody was really confused, because most people that are being treated for a recent trauma, I mean, you have flashbacks of that trauma, but you don't have flashbacks of something else. And I was getting worse instead of better, even though I was on all this medication, different group therapies, and I was being hospitalized on suicide watch, and I wasn't getting any better. I was getting worse. I escaped a couple of times, but they got me back.
From the hospital?
The way the memories start coming back is they deliberately do this. They layer them, the memories, so that you'll remember memories of your, like family memories. Like, I remembered my mother abusing me. And then you remember things that don't, you know, that don't have anything to do with, nothing to do with Tulane or any outside doctors. It was just, I thought I was abused by my mother and her friends. Mm-hmm. And then I remembered the camp across the lake, and that led to remembering Tulane, and that led to remembering the other places I had been to, and it just sort of snowballs. And they keep coming, you know, one after another. It's really hard to live while you're getting all these memories back. And if I didn't have personalities, I probably wouldn't be alive, because they came out and, you know, when you're going through these memories, you can't just say, okay, well, I don't want to remember tonight, I want to eat dinner. You can't do that. So you go away and let someone else come out, and they can eat for you or sleep, or, you know, so you're not in a constant flashback.
How did going to therapy at the time help you cope with dealing with all of these memories coming back?
Well, it kept me safe, for one thing. Valerie made sure that, you know, I had to make a contract with her that I wouldn't hurt myself, or if I thought about hurting myself, I would tell her first. She had to make a contract with each of the personalities that were coming out, the ones that came out the most. You know, not everybody comes out at once. Obviously, if I have almost 100 personalities, they're not all going to be coming out at once, but over the years they come out, and some only come out one time, and then that's it, they integrate. They come back, they come out to give you a memory, and then they go inside you and integrate, because their job is done.
Mm-hmm.
But the therapy kept me going, I mean, from day to day. There were lots of nights I'd end up calling her in the middle of the night, you know, just and she tried to contain the flashbacks. That's the worst part, is the flashbacks. Because you actually are in the memory as if it's happening right then and there. And my husband would try to get me out of the flashback, and I would think he was the person hurting me, you know, and I would fight him. So, it more or less, it's a safety thing. You need to stay safe, and you don't want to be drugged all the time, so... and you don't want to be in the hospital all the time. So therapy is really important.
Can, Can you describe the approach that your therapist took with you to help you heal and to help you remember?
Okay, well, I guess the first part of healing is the remembering part. And what she does for that is really just be there. She doesn't encourage you to remember. You start remembering and you can't help it. And she'll just sort of be there and saying, what else do you remember? Just sort of someone to give you memory to remember and tell someone that believes you, you know, because that's a big part of it, is having someone believe you, because it's important to you. You remember this awful stuff, and once you get past the point of denying it, and you understand that it did happen, then you need someone else to believe that it happened. It's just part of the healing process. And so she was there to help me remember it, to stay safe while I remembered it, because, like I said, it's actually as if you're going through the whole incident itself. I mean, you feel the pain, the body pain. Whatever happened to you then, you feel the same pain. You feel like you're being held down or whatever it is that's happening. You can actually feel, like if you're tied down, you can feel the ties on you. You can feel it against your skin. It's a very weird sensation. I mean, it's almost like you're hallucinating, but you're not. You're just trapped back in this memory. And she keeps you from hurting yourself, from running out the door, which you try to do. You know, you try to escape because you come in and out of the memory. It's not a constant thing. You're in the process of remembering something awful, and somehow you click in. The here and now will click in, and you say, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to get the hell out of here. And you start running for the door. And she's had to catch me, you know, and obviously keep me safe inside of a room. A lot of people can only do this in a hospital. Well, I was lucky. I have a therapist who does it outside of the hospital, because it's not a very good environment for doing it, being in a hospital. It's much easier to do it in some place familiar that's more like a second home to you than, you know, this hospital environment, because a lot of the stuff did happen in hospitals. Mm-hmm. So that's the last place I want to be.
Right.
And like I said, verifying the memories afterwards, after it's all over with and you finished it, then you talk about it, you process it, and then I would ask her, please try to find out, was there a man named James Hamilton from California? You know, was there ever a doctor by this name? Is there such a place as Vacaville, California? Something like that. And so she would call her consultant, call these people that were experts and say, okay, well, this is the information she gave me. Because she would have no idea, you know. She purposely didn't read any of the material that was being published. Because she didn't want to accidentally contaminate my memories, you know, by giving me any information. So she says as little as possible during the thing, other than encouraging me to talk. Mm-hmm. And basically hanging on to you sometimes.
Now, there's been some material published about the describing traumatic memory and in the different way that it's processed inside the brain as opposed to regular memory, in that it does kind of take you back to that raw experience, and including body memories, and that sounds like what was your experience as well.
Right. That's good, raw experience. That's a good description.
Did you find that you had to relive all of the memories that in order to integrate that identity that had that memory, or were there other ways of dealing with it?
Well, I'm told that not everyone does their memories differently. Everyone heals in a different way. For me in particular, it's important for me to go through the memory. Why, I don't know. If I had my choice, I would say, I don't want to do any of the memories. I just want to talk about it and say, well, this happened on such and such a day, and I was 12 years old, and this, you know, I would rather talk about it, of course, rather than experience it. But for some reason, I can't put it behind me and go on and deal with it unless I've actually gone through it again. Only this time when you're going through it, you do have a sense that it happened a long time ago, that the person's not really there anymore, and that you're safe. That's the only difference. You do have this, like, sensation that you know Valerie's there, the therapist is there, even though you're caught back in a different time and a different place, you still have this sense of this person who's safe and that she's not going to let them, you know, really hurt you, and that this person's not going to come back and get you, and that no one else knows about it, that it's, you know, private. But for me, I have to experience a memory. I have to get the full memory from the shadow that experienced it at the time. She gives it to me, and then she goes inside or integrates. And that's where most of my shadows have gone, you know. Once they gave me the memory, they integrated.
Right. And just to clarify for our listeners, when you're saying she, that you're really meaning other identities within yourself.
Yes.
Right.
They're all, yes, my identities or alters, and I call them shadows. So when I say shadows, I mean my alters, mm-hmm. are all little girls. The oldest is 16 years old, and the youngest is a year old. And that's at all 100 of them. They were all little girls. And I don't have any boys, men, animals, objects, robots, anything like that, but other people have. Mine are just me at different ages. And I might have, like, 5 that are 10 years old, you know. So that's why I have so many. Because there were some years when it was really bad and things happened a lot. And I missed most of that year of school. And it's a miracle that I passed school, that I never was held back a grade. And we actually went back and checked my school records. And that verified some of the information because we found the records the days that I missed school, and they coincided with my memory, and I missed almost every like Thursdays and Fridays. I missed a lot of Thursdays and Fridays because I would go away for the weekend, you know. I don't have any pictures of me at any birthday because I was always sent away for my birthday. I don't have any pictures of Christmas, but I have lots of pictures of me at Easter time because I was always home for Easter because Easter's a big Catholic holiday and I was raised Catholic, and of course you have to be at church on Easter Sunday or people will ask questions. But for some reason on Christmas nobody asked any questions and I was always gone during Christmas. But for other people, they don't have to go through the memory. They can just talk about it. For myself, I had to go through each one. Almost every single one that I had. There's very few that I'm able to just process and talk about and not have to experience it again. I guess it makes it real for me. I guess that's why I have to do it.
Mm-hmm. And how long has your healing process been so far? Are you still in therapy now? Or?
Yes, I am. But I'm back at work now, almost full-time as a nurse. And I was out of work 4.5 years. When I wasn't able to, you know, I was on disability because I was in therapy so much, you know, almost every day of the week, you know, except the weekend. I was unable to work. I mean, I was just too exhausted. I was on medication. Now I'm going to therapy once, maybe twice a week. And it's mainly just processing, talking about all the things that happened, talking about how I feel about the people. I've already gotten all the memories back, so that part is over. The worst is over. Actually having to remember in every detail, that's done already. And that happened during, I'd say, the spring of 93 until right before Christmas of this year.
So when you actually gave testimony at the radiation hearings, you were, what, only about halfway through? Remembering everything?
A little more than halfway through the memories.
Mm-hmm.
So if I gave the testimony now, it would be a lot more accurate, a lot more detailed, a lot more names, mm-hmm. places, because there were things I hadn't even remembered yet. But it was enough that that could be validated, and enough that they were interested in. Thank goodness.
Now, you also have a photographic memory.
I have a shadow who has a photographic memory.
I see.
So I can use a photographic memory, but I don't have access to it at all times. In other words, Claudia doesn't have the photographic memory. A part of me does.
Uh-huh.
I don't have it 100% of the time. But I used it a lot when I was growing up, because unconsciously it was very important for me to remember everything that happened to me, every name, every face. I wanted to remember these people that were hurting me. I didn't know why I wanted to remember. Maybe I thought unconsciously that there'd be somebody to tell someday, somebody that would listen to me. Because they were always telling you not to tell, that it was a secret. That horrible things would happen if you told anybody. And I did try to tell twice as I was growing up. Tried to tell two different people, and both times I got punished for it. So I learned my lesson that you didn't tell anybody.
Who were these people that you had told?
When I was seven. I told the school nurse. I had been to camp the weekend before, to Mr. Fenner's camp across the lake, and had a really rough time, and I was bleeding vaginally. I had bruises, scrapes all over me, and my mother would send me to school with this leotards, flesh-colored leotards on, and stockings, you know, like a little ballet suit, only it was flesh-colored, and I would wear that under my uniform so that it hid all the bruises and the scrapes and everything, and she'd put like a pad on me, you know, like adults were, you know, like you use for your period, and she sent me to school, and I went to the school nurse because my teacher thought I looked really pale and not feeling well, and so she sent me to the nurse, and I told the nurse, she said, who did this to you, or how did this happen to you, because she saw I was bleeding and everything, and I had a temperature, I had a fever, and I said, my mother did. And she said, you know, well, no, really. How did it happen? And I said, my mother did it. And she let this man do something to me, and I don't want to go home. And so she told me to lay down and take a nap, and that she would take care of it. And I thought she was going to call the police and have my mother arrested. And instead she called my mother to come pick me up, and she said, I thought you ought to know what your daughter was saying about you. Jeez. And, of course, I missed school after that for a few days because she took it out on me.
Your mother punished you.
And then when I was 14, I told somebody. And once again, they told my mother. No, actually, they told my monitor, Dr. Brown, the family friend who was keeping an eye on me, who was best friends with Mr. Fenner and also with Robert Heath from Tulane. And he was friends with a lot of the people from the CIA, too. He actually worked with Martin Orne in the 50s, so he was friends with him. And I told him what was happening. You know, I said, bad things are happening. I don't want to go home. I don't want to go to see doctors anymore. And, of course, he punished me. And then he told my mother. So that was the only two times I ever told anybody something was going on. And then I learned my lesson not to tell. But I kept everything filed away in my photographic memory. I mean, I remembered whole conversations, what everybody looked like, what they were wearing, what they sounded like, what the places looked like, what it felt like, you know, everything. And that's why I've been able to give so much information. It's not just blurs of vague things that happen to me. It's very detailed, and I'm told that that's not very common, that most people don't remember a lot of details. They remember the feelings and the pain and the sensations, but they don't remember small details. They try not to. So I'm told that's kind of unusual.
I wonder if we could go into some of these details that you do remember. If you could talk about some of the people involved in the experiments.
Okay. Since there was so many, you have to tell me, like, little more detail. Like,
yeah, maybe
what
you could
science do you want to know about, or what, at what age?
Maybe you could go chronologically. What kind of experiments were they doing at the start, and who was involved? And if you knew what the different projects were at the time.
Okay, well, like I told you before, when I was 8 years old, I was told I was going to be tested to see if I could participate or take part in this big project. And they kept calling it projects. And it was for the President of the United States, and to help stop communism, and it sounded very exciting. And so these people, I was told the doctors and these important people were going to come from all over the country to test me. And I mainly was at Tulane for the test. And some of the tests were like, they gave me personality tests. And usually if it was a man, well, it was mostly men that were involved. There was one woman that I remember distinctly, and Phyllis Greenacre. And she was from a place called Cornell. I didn't even know that that was a school at the time. You know, I just remembered the word Cornell. And but the rest of them were men, and most of them would say, call me Uncle so-and-so. So Uncle John came from Oklahoma and tested me for personality to see... he had names for different types of tests, but basically I think what he was testing was to see how my personality, who I would fit in best with, who I'd get along with the best. I think they already had an idea of what they wanted to use me for, but they had to see specifically what I would be most useful, how I could help the, you know, projects the most. And he tested me and said that I got along best with older men, daddies, or uncles, that that's what I was looking for, affection from older men. Because in my own life, my mother was so dominant and so horrible, you know, and scary, and my father was real sickly, my adopted father was sickly and very weak, never stood up to my mother, knew what was going on, never stopped it. And so here I was looking for this strong man to come along and save me. And so that's why I guess I reacted best with older men. So his name was Uncle John, and he was also known as the Gittinger Man. I had to remember these people by characteristics they had, or by the clothes they wore, or by maybe something they talked about, or something odd about them. Because there were so many people coming and going in my life, it would have been impossible just to remember names and put faces with them and where they were from. So I would call them by different nicknames. And John Gittinger was the goatee man, because I asked him, I told him he had a funny-looking beard, and he said it's called a goatee. And the first time I'd ever heard that expression, a goatee. So I called him the goatee man. And then there was... Dr. Uncle Sid, who was Gottlieb, and I called him the man with the pebble in his shoe because he walked funny. He had a limp, and he mainly just talked to me. I don't know what he specifically was looking for, but he just wanted to kind of get an idea of what I was like and how I reacted. Did I obey what, you know? Was I obedient? Did I have... They would test me for memory. And, of course, I had a very good memory. And that was important. They did IQ test.
You are listening to an interview with Claudia Mullen, a survivor of U.S. government mind control experimentation and of being used as a mind control agent for the U.S. government. Stay tuned for the second half of this interview for International Connection on CKLM.